Hello, 1517 Podcast listeners. This is Caleb Keith, director of the 1517 Podcast Network, with a brief announcement for you. 1517 will be participating in Giving Tuesday this year, that is November 28th, with a $200,000 goal. Our Giving Tuesday campaign has a matching fund this year, and so every dollar you give will be matched. We appreciate your support for the podcast network and for the rest of what 1517 does. We work hard to provide high-quality, Christ-centered resources every single day of the week. If you've been enjoying this podcast or many of the other things at 1517, we ask you to please consider supporting 1517 during this crucial time. The end of the year is important for us as we look to close our budgetary needs for 2023 and start off strong in 2024. A $200,000 goal is ambitious, but I know with the support of our listeners on the podcast network and many of the other friends and partners of 1517 that we will be able to reach this goal. Please consider supporting your favorite podcast and the rest of the projects at 1517 today by going to 1517.org/GivingTuesday and making a gift, or you can follow the link in the show notes below that says support this podcast on Giving Tuesday. We thank all of you who continue to partner with 1517 to provide these resources, and I hope you enjoyed this episode of your favorite 1517 podcast.
Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 podcast, network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, check out the events page. You can still register for the Here We Still Stand regional event in Northwest Arkansas. Might want to do it now. Tickets will not last long. It is mostly sold out. I think we're about, 80% of the way there. So if you want to grab a ticket, now would be the time to do so. Love to see you there. There's a link in the show notes as well. Chad, we are in Job chapter 8. We got into a little bit of Bildad, his response to Job. Essentially, he says to Job at the beginning of this anyway, where we were at, and we kind of ended with him saying, hey, Job, sounds like you're saying that God kind of perverts justice. That's what kind of seems like what you're saying. Sounds like you're suggesting that the Almighty perverts the right, the just, the good, the true, all the things. And surely you wouldn't be saying that. I mean, surely whatever is happening to you is justified. It must be, unless you're becoming a blasphemer, Job. That is kind of how it ended. He also suggested that maybe God should just, or maybe that Job should just seek God. Maybe that would be a good idea, as if Job hadn't thought of this before. Like, just seek God and maybe plead with him for mercy. And if you're, the right kind of guy, if you're pious, he'll answer you. And that's kind of where we ended. And we'll see how he continues.
Yeah, he even goes so far as to promise that, you were great before all of this stuff went down with your family, your possessions, your health, your everything. But, if you'll do what's right, then your latter days are going to be very great. You thought you were great before. Well, just wait.
You know what's weird about
things
that?
Things are going to get much better.
What's weird about that is that turns, not to spoil the ending, but that does turn out to be the case.
Mm-hmm.
But just because that turns out to be the case doesn't mean that is in any way comforting to someone. Like, if you lose 10 kids and then you're like, don't worry, you're going to have more kids. That's not helpful, right? That's not comforting.
No, kids. More kids being born don't replace the kids you've lost.
No, that's not.
It doesn't work. It's not like, oh well, I lost my car. My car caught fire, exploded, but I'll get another car. It'll be fine. I'll get the exact same car as before. That's not the way it works with relationships.
And it doesn't. And even in I don't know what's the right way to say this. A harder, colder time, which this is. I mean, in a time where people are much more familiar with loss and unexpected death and this sort of stuff, right? I mean, like, certainly modern times, when we experience that kind of stuff, it's very different, not very different, but somewhat different than previous times where people's life expectancies were shorter. You didn't have modern medicine. There's war was brutal. How many people died for lack of antibiotics being invented, right? Like there's a lot of dudes that died in old school military conflict for lack of penicillin. You know, if penicillin had been invented, there'd be a lot less death because it wasn't just like, oh, I got stabbed and died. It was, I got cut. I got infected because I got, you know, I took a sword to the leg and I died that way. So they're much more familiar with death. Death is not the thing that it is now. But even still, if you're talking about something unexpected and tragic and all-encompassing like this, I don't think saying, well, all that stuff's going to be restored to you if you'll just say the right words is in any way helpful, even though he does have things restored to him. I don't think Job in any way suggests at the end, when Job does get blessed, that somehow negates his suffering.
Yeah. I mean, plus the premise of what he's saying is false, too, because his premise is that Job has sinned, and therefore if he will turn and seek God, make amends with God, then God will make his latter days to be very great. So no comfort now, and also a false premise on the part of Job's friend. So, and then Bildad goes on, verse 8, to say, listen, I'm not the one who came up with this. What you need to do is you need to inquire into bygone ages and figure out what the fathers have said before us. So inquire of bygone ages, consider what the fathers have searched out. For who are we? I mean, we are but of yesterday and know nothing. It's probably one of the truest things to Bildad said.
That's probably it.
We are but of yesterday, no other thing. You're right about that. For our days on earth are a shadow. Will they not teach you and tell you in utter words out of their understanding? Well, I mean, this is another one of these examples where it's true. I mean, in the sense of, yeah, we should always beware of anyone who, talking here, especially in the theological realm, anyone who says something theologically that no one has ever said before is immediately suspect.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, novelty in theology is a very dangerous game to play. So what he says is truthful. I mean, we should always be inquiring into bygone ages. What can we learn from the wisdom of the past? We all stand on the shoulders of giants. I think that's a C.S. Lewis image, for sure. But that doesn't mean that the fathers of bygone ages are actually agreeing with Bildad.
Right.
Or that what they said applies in the situation of Job. You can have wisdom from the past, which is true, but it's not necessarily applicable to every situation in which we find ourselves. And I mean, that's a theme that runs through all of these responses of Job's friends. What they say many times is not untrue. It's just unapplicable to Job's situation. I mean, we encounter situations like this all the time. Many of the things they say are very proverbial. It's kind of stuff you'd find in the Psalms, kind of stuff you'd find in the Proverbs, but their application of it to the very specific sufferings of Job are not only wrong, but cruel, because they assume what is not true about Job's situation. So anyway, he goes on, verse 11, to kind of paint an image here of nature, kind of parabolic, I suppose we'd say, and then apply that to Job. He says, can papyrus grow where there is no marsh? Can reeds flourish where there is no water? Well, of course, they have to have marsh, they have to have water. That's where papyrus, that's where reeds grow. While yet in flower and not cut down, they wither before any other plant. Such are the paths of all who forget God. The hope of the godless shall perish. So the basic parable is, hey, you know, you can have these papyrus reeds, and this is kind of an aside here, but that's the way that they made ancient papyrus. So manuscripts used to be made out of, they didn't have paper. They had parchment, which is leather. But a lot of the early manuscripts were made out of papyrus. So you take a papyrus plant, you cut it, and you actually make these pages, as it were, out of the parts of the papyrus plant. So they have to have water to grow. And his point is that, yeah, well, they have water, whether in a marsh, well, they flower. They grow. We experience this, of course. You know, you plant a flower, if it has water, you plant a crop, if it has water, it's going to grow. you take the water away, it's going to die. He says, well, that's what happens for all who forget God. The goddess shall perish. They're going to wither just like the papyrus plant when it has no water. Of course, the implication here is that this is what's happening in the case of Job. He's cut himself off from the source of life. He's cut himself off from God. And because of that, he's withering. He's perishing.
Yeah, I mean, the not so subtle implication here is like, such are the paths of all who forget God. So the implication here is that you are on such a path, Job. And he does this like, I mean, have you not inquired of God? Have you not sought God? Have you not come before him and confessed? And it's like, I think you're on the wrong path here, Job. I think you're on the path of what? I think you're on the path of those who have forgotten God. And this is why you don't have any hope. Like, the hope of the godless shall perish. You're sitting here and you're looking and acting rather hopeless, and that's because you've forgotten God, which of course is preposterous. I mean, God, Job has been addressing, he addressed God for the second half of his very long speech. I mean, he addressed his friends for a chapter, he addressed God for a chapter, so he hasn't forgotten about God. In fact, Job is in this weird situation where he's like, God, I wish God would forget me.
Yeah, I was going to say, he wishes God would forget him, but it's not happening.
I mean, there's nothing worse than saying, like, God is so against me that he won't let me die.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So forgetting God is not Job's problem.
No.
Job's problem is, we wish God would forget him. Just, you know, leave him alone for a little bit. Just let him go ahead and perish and be done with it. So, Bildad's going to go on to verse 14 to... he's got all of these images that are kind of woven together here. He's been talking about the papyrus plant. Now he's going to switch to a spider's web. His says that the godless, his confidence, that is the confidence of the godless, is going to be severed. His trust, a spider's web. You got to give these guys points for their rhetorical flourishes. I mean, that is good. If your trust is a spider's web, well, then there, you know, not much of a trust there, you know.
It's, yeah,
it might be strong as far as web quality goes, but it's not going to hold if something weighty is placed upon that.
And is
so
this
if your trust is a spider's web? It's ready to snap.
Yeah, is this a word here? Web is it more like it's translated web because a web is where a spider lives, but in the Hebrew here, is it? His trust is like a spider's dwelling or a spider's house, and then in 15
yeah,
he says
house.
Yeah, spider's, which is a funny thing to say, right? So his trust is a spider's house, which of course is a web. He leans against his house, but it does not stand. So it's like a spider lives in a web, and that's a spider's home. That's the home you have. You have a little spider's house, and but when you lean against that, it's no good. Webs are not real sturdy.
I mean, the ESV has that in the footnote. This is a case where I wish they'd have just translated it quite literally. His trust is a spider's house. That way, you know, when you see the very next line, he leans against his house, you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah, because you
obviously
don't.
Obviously, the same words being used here.
He's talking about the web right here. Like, he's talking, like, yeah, these are connected. Otherwise, you might think he's transitioning into some other analogy.
Yeah, I like Robert Alter translate this a little bit differently. He translates it, his faith is a mere cobweb, a spider's house, his trust. He leans on his house and it will not stand. So he captures the essence of what's being communicated.
You ever tried to lean on a spider's web? You ever been out in the yard working real hard and maybe you grab that glass of lemonade and you see a spider's web and you're like, let me just lean on this real quick.
You know, I've run through several spider's webs.
It's the worst.
Walked through them. It's the worst, yeah.
You feel like you have multiple spiders on you for like some time after that, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah, there's nothing will make you slap your face quicker than running through a spider's web.
Nothing will make you want to like strip down naked faster than running through a big old spider. You're like, check your whole body.
Yeah. Terrible, terrible feeling. So he leans against his house, doesn't stand. He lays hold of it. It does not endure, of course, because that's what spiders' houses do. And now he's done with his spider imagery. Now he's going to shift to something else. He's going to talk about plants and roots and things like that. He is a lush plant before the sun, and his shoots spread over his garden. His roots entwine the stone heap. He looks upon a house of stones. If he is destroyed from his place, then it will deny him, saying, I have never seen you. Behold, this is the joy of his way, and out of the soil others will spring. There's a ton of issues here with the Hebrew and a little bit, you know, uncertainty as to what some of these things mean. But I think the overall image is pretty clear. It's I picture like you've got this tree or this plant, whatever, has a lot of roots, and they're just kind of growing everywhere. You know, they're entwining all the stones and whatnot all over the house of stones. And if something happens, you know, and people come along and say, well, you know, who did this belong to, or whose place was this? The place itself is going to say, I don't know, I've never seen you. You know, there's no remembrance of him. In other words, he's going to go the way of all flesh, and then out of the soil, others will spring. He's going to be replaced by somebody else. The overall effect is the ephemeral nature of human existence. So you're here, you're gone. Especially if you're godless, you're going to be forgotten. You're going to pass away, and lo, you are no more.
And it seems like as Job's houses are rubble at this point, that this makes sense that he would be saying, yeah, man, you're going to be like, people are going to walk by this rubble and be like, hey, who lived here? And everyone's going to be like, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, and this is not one of these cases where it's not untrue. I mean, one of the Psalms say, you know, look at this guy. He's spreading himself like what's the Psalm say? So like a luxuriant vine, and then lo, he was no more. I searched for him. He couldn't be found.
Yeah.
You know, such is the way of those who deny God. So it's not wrong.
It just doesn't apply.
Just doesn't apply. Yeah. You can't be running around and every time you see somebody suffering and say, oh, well, that's what happens to the godless.
I don't know, man. When that tower fell on those people, what did they do?
Were they
exactly
worse sinners? Yeah. Were they worse sinners than anybody else? So to wrap up his argument here at the end of chapter 8, he says, that's the way of the godless. But behold, God will not reject a blameless man, nor take the hand of evildoers. So if you're blameless, God's not going to reject you. But he's also not going to have anything to do with evildoers. He will yet fill your mouth with laughter and your lips with shouting. Those who hate you will be clothed with shame, and the tent of the wicked will be no more. All of which, I mean, sounds okay. You know, just there's still hope, Job. I know you're lamenting now. You're really upset. You've got pus oozing sores all over your body. But a day is coming when your mouth will laugh. Your lips will shout. Everybody who hates you, they're going to be clothed with shame. The tent of the wicked will perish. So better days are coming. And the only way you're going to get there is really by listening to my theological advice and following the way that I've laid out for you.
You know what's interesting about this is that he says, listen, God's not going to reject a blameless guy. So we got to figure this out. Which reminds you of the opening of Job, which was, there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright. He's telling this to, like, yeah, the only blameless guy according to the text in the story, right? Like, so there's like one blameless guy. His name is Job, and then his friends come around like, man, if you could just be blameless, like, this is the blameless. Like, but he is, according to God.
Yeah, you can imagine the look on Job's face when that line came out of Bildad's mouth. God will not reject a blameless man. Job's like, looks pretty much like he has.
Yeah, you sure about that? I mean, are you sure about that?
Maybe it would have been better if God had rejected me, because he didn't reject me now. I mean, look what's happening to me.
Yeah.
So, well, that wraps up chapter 8. That's Bildad's first go at explaining, going to explain this to Job, his sufferings. And now Job is going to reply. And, you know, I mentioned this before, but keep in mind, these replies, this is not like a formal debate session. You know, person A stands up, they give their argument. Person B stands up, they give their argument. And then, you know, person A responds to B, and B responds to A. This is not a very structured response kind of argument. There is some responses built into it. But these are more like, I'm going to try and give a speech which explains better what's going on than the other guy. So it's kind of a speech competition more than it is a response back and forth. But Job is going to give his speech now after Bildad sits down and is done.
Yeah, and what's interesting about Job's response is that Job's going to start, and I think that his first words are addressing these final words about like God won't reject a blameless man, and Job's going to say like, yeah, I know that. Here's the issue, though, if I was going to condense the first little portion of Job's response. I know that God won't reject a blameless man, but check it out. Who really knows what God is like and what he likes and what he doesn't like and what he thinks and why he does what he does? And Job seems to be responding from a place of like, yeah, but to be blameless before God, you'd have to like really know God. And I'm starting to wonder if I understand God at all.
Yeah, I mean, if you, these first 12 verses especially, almost are reaching forward to God's speech. I mean, there's some things in here which is like, I think Job is already anticipating what God himself is going to say in those closing chapters when he begins to speak. Yeah, he starts out, truly I know that this is so. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, yeah, I think there is a response. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, I mean, what you're saying is not completely untrue. But how can a man be in the right before God? But that's a good question to ask of the scriptures. Right?
Yes.
How can a man? I mean, you're talking about like cutting right to the heart of things. All right, let me ask a question. How can a man be in the right before God? That's kind of that is the Christian question, right? How can we be right before God?
Yeah.
Well, Job's response, I mean, we know our response. Well, there's one way you can be right before God. No question about it. You are clothed in the righteousness of Christ, and your sins are forgiven, and he has made you right with his Father so that there's no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. That's the answer to Job chapter 9, verse 2.
Yeah, because what's sort of baked into this response is, okay, you're right. God won't reject the blameless, but what exactly is a man going to do to be blameless? What is a man, how can a man be right with God? Is there something that an unrighteous man could do to then become righteous? And this is the question, because the answer to that is nothing.
Yeah,
because that's not how righteousness works, right? So, like, if you are not blameless, there is no becoming blameless because of something that you now do. Like, this is the thing you must do to become blameless. There's nothing you can do.
Mm-hmm. Righteousness is not gained by practicing righteousness.
No,
that's worse, utterly contrary to every human experience, because we get better by doing things, right? You get better at basketball by doing what? Playing basketball.
Mm-hmm.
You get better at whatever you're doing by doing that thing. Well, you don't get better at righteousness by practicing righteousness. It doesn't work that way. It's going to be a gift instead of an achievement.
Yeah, well, it's one of those things that once you're not that thing, there is no becoming that thing either. Like, there's, you can't undo your unrighteousness. There's no way for you to do this, right? And so since you were born in iniquity and sin, like, righteousness, it's not exactly in the cards for you. Like, there's no, you're not ever going to be that. You have to have always been that. This is why you need the righteousness of one who has always been righteous. Because if you're not that, you'll never be that. That's how it works.
So, Job here asked the question, "How can this be? How can man be the right before God?" And he goes on to say, you know, if you wanted to like go to court with him, if you want to contend with him, you couldn't answer him a thousand times. So that contend with him in Hebrew is a technical term for like going to trial, right? So if you are contending with someone, you're in trial with them, and Job says, if this happens, you know, if I'm going to be in the right before God and go to court with him, I couldn't answer him. No one could answer him once in 1,000 times. There's no way you could really respond to God. And then he goes into this very wisdom kind of description where he's going to talk about nature and all kinds of elements of creation. He says, he is wise in heart and mighty in strength. Who has hardened himself against him and succeeded? He who removes mountains and they know it not. When he overturns him in his anger, he shakes the earth out of its place and its pillars tremble. Who commands the sun and it doesn't rise? Who seals up the stars? Who alone stretched out the heavens and trampled the waves of the sea? Who made the Bear and Orion, the Pleiades and the chambers of the south? Who does great things beyond searching out and marvelous things beyond number? Behold, he passes by me and I see him not. He moves on, but I do not perceive him. Behold, he snatches away. Who can turn him back? And who will say to him, that is, who will say to God, what are you doing? it's true. I mean, there's nothing in here. This is not real. This is different. This is a different kind of approach that Job has taken from the past. I mean, this is all. I think the kind of the tone behind it is frustration, mm-hmm. because that's the way he begins. So, I mean, yeah. How can it, you can't be right with God. You take him to trial. If he asks you a question, you know, 1,000 questions, you're not gonna be able to answer even one of them. And the reason is because he's all this stuff that I described. He's wise in heart. He's mighty in strength. And he not only, you know, like makes mountains, he can remove mountains. He's the one who makes the stars do their starring and the sun do its sunning. I mean, he's the power behind all of this. So what chance do you have with him? In fact, if he like moves by you, you don't see him. You can't perceive him. And who is going to say to God, what are you doing? Well, I mean, you can't. He is unsearchable. He's unfathomable. He's God, and we're not. So this is not the kind of response that we have seen so far in Job. I think it is uttered from a position of frustration, but he at least is, as it were, praising God for who he is, even in the midst of his frustration.
Well, it seems like that he's responding to this idea that just do the thing that you know that God wants you to do. And I think his answer is, are you sure you know what it is that this God wants people to do? Listen, it's easy for me to try to like think of what someone might want me to do or what words someone might want to hear, right? So if you're in a conflict with your spouse, you might be able to think, like, what could I say that could make this better? And you could try to put yourself in her position and all this stuff because, I don't know, you're both just creatures. You're just people. Joe's being like, dude, there's not a way for you to try to come up with the right things. How would you possibly know what this a God like this really wanted to hear from you? I mean, you could give him an answer 1,000 times and never get this thing right. Look at the kind of God this is. I mean, you can't see him. He's making the sun do its shining. He's doing all this stuff. I'm starting to wonder if I understand this God at all. In fact, I don't know if anyone can even just say to him in the midst of what he's doing, I don't know if you can ask him, what are you doing? Because like, this is like another way of saying his ways are not like our ways. He's not like us. And so I don't know that you can know exactly what the magic words that he wants to hear to make all of this go away are. He's way bigger than that. You're acting as though God is much more like you than he is.
Yeah. Yeah, they've kind of flattened God out. You know,
yeah.
They've made him just a very predictable, very easy to understand, a very non-mysterious God. And, you know, it's like, oh, well, the God is just, he's a rule giver. And if you just keep his rules, everything's cool, you know. And Job's like, oh, do you really know God?
Yeah.
Do you think you can just sit down and have a regular conversation with God and he's very understandable and you know exactly what he wants you to do? No, he's well beyond that.
Or that you would, you would be able to know this is what God always, God thinks this is right and this is wrong all the time. It's easy to understand it, right? Like, it's easy to be blameless. Obviously, you just think about what God would like, and then you do those things. You think about what he would dislike, and you don't do those things. So simple.
All you got to do, here's ABC, do ABC, and you're good with God. So he goes on, verse 13, God will not turn back his anger. Beneath him bow the helpers of Rahab. How then can I answer him, choosing my words with him? Though I am in the right, I cannot answer him. I must appeal for mercy to my accuser. So, first of all, the helpers of Rahab, this is not like the Rahab we're probably familiar with from the beginning of Joshua, the prostitute there in Jericho. This is that, which is actually spelled differently in Hebrew than this Rahab. That's more Rahav. This is, I think we've talked about Rahab before. This is the mythological sea creature that often pops up in the Bible. So he's using this mythological language to talk about God's power over the elements of creation here, which are called by the name of Rahab. So God won't turn back his anger. Beneath him bow the helpers of Rahab. So how can I answer him? I mean, what kind of words am I going to use to speak to him? How can I choose my words with him? Even if I love verse 15, though I am in the right, I mean, even if I'm right about this, I can't answer him. I must appeal for mercy to my accuser. So Job's saying, listen, even if I am in the right, even if I am where I need to be, I still can't answer him. He's beyond my ability to respond to. All I can do is appeal for mercy.
Yeah, and this appeal for mercy from his accuser. I mean, it's not just, he's appealing to like both his accuser and judge, right? The person that's going to make the decision. It's not just as though he has got an accuser and somebody else is going to give the verdict. This is he believes that God is both accusing him and going to be the one that delivers the judgment. And what's interesting about that is he's saying, like, it'd be like if you were accused of something you didn't do by a judge. And then you're like, okay, maybe I can carefully construct my words, and because I know I'm not guilty of this thing. I didn't do this thing, and this judge thinks I did this thing. And then you realize, like, that's not going to work. So now, like, all that's left for me to do is to appeal for mercy from this person for something I don't think I'm guilty of.
Yeah, and how do you do that? I mean, if you're in the right, how do you appeal for mercy when, according to your own self-understanding, you don't really need mercy? You just need a right and proper judgment.
Yeah, so it's like if you were
on the horns of a dilemma.
Yeah, it's like if you got, like, pulled over for speeding, and you, I mean, this is trite, but, like, if you got pulled over for speeding, and he's like, you're doing 100 miles an hour, and you're like, dude, I was doing 30 miles an hour. What? No. Like, it's like he clocked a different car that was the same exact car as your car. And then you're like, no, I clocked you. And you're like, no, that was that car. That wasn't me.
Yeah.
And you're starting to realize, okay, I didn't do this thing, but I am going to have to pay this ticket. And maybe I'm going to switch tactics here. Maybe I'm just going to say, I just would really like the court to be lenient. I'm just going to go ahead and ask for mercy. Even though I know I didn't do this thing, I think I can't win this debate.
Yeah, you can't appeal for mercy without at least implicitly acknowledging guilt, right?
Yeah.
So that's what he's done. I must appeal for mercy to my accuser. So if I summoned him and he answered me, I wouldn't believe that he was listening to my voice. Job is like, he's at the point where he doesn't know what to do. Listen, let's say I summon him, all right, and he actually answered, then I'm not at the point where I would even believe that he was listening to me. I'm so far gone that even if he does say something, it's really hard for me to believe that he was listening when he gave the response because of who he is. And I mean, what has he done? Well, verse 17, he says he's He's crushed me with a tempest and multiplies my wounds without cause. He won't even let me catch my breath, and he fills me with bitterness. So this is the Job that we've been familiar with. I mean, he's not talking about being crushed, and he's wounded, and God's like chasing him. He's the image I get here. He won't even let Job like stop and catch his breath, but he's chasing him, he's pursuing him, and he's full of bitterness. And he says, verse 19, if it's a contest of strength, I mean, if it's a wrestling match between me and God, well, I don't stand any chance because he's mighty. If it's a matter of justice, well, then who can really summon him? I mean, he's the judge of judges. He's the king of kings. He's the one who sits on the ultimate judgment throne. So who's going to be able to summon him? Though I'm in the right, my own mouth would condemn me. And though I am blameless, he would prove me perverse. No hope, in other words. Any way that the joke turns, if he summons him and God answers, he's not going to believe that he responds. But he can't even really summon him because he's the ultimate judge. And, you know, even if he's in the right, then he's going to say something that is going to condemn him. And even though he's blameless, God is going to find something in him that proves he's perverse. So he does this dance back and forth where it's like he's moving around, looking at every option he has. And every option that he has is basically a door slammed in his face, no matter what he does.
Yeah, I mean, this is he feels very powerless in this. It's like he's essentially saying here, like this. I could demand to go to court, but I feel like this court is rigged because that guy's got all the power.
Yeah, yeah. Just imagine you're what like people like me or you who don't have a legal background. It's like we're summoned to make our argument before the Supreme Court. Yeah, and just to kind of make the situation even more ludicrous, everybody on the Supreme Court, let's say, are people that don't like us. So that is the odds that Job feels. He's standing before all of this almighty judge, and he looks and he's like, you know, it doesn't matter what I do. It doesn't matter what I say. It doesn't matter what argument I put forward. Nothing is going to work for me. And then he goes on to verse 21. He says, I am blameless. I regard not myself. I loathe my life. It's all one. Therefore, I say he destroys both the blameless and the wicked. When disaster brings sudden death, he mocks at the calamity of the innocent. The earth is given into the hand of the wicked. He covers the face of its judges. And if it's not he, that is, if God is not the one doing this, then who is it? So he's some bitterness, I think, is creeping in here.
Well, he says he's full of bitterness. So
against God. I mean, when he says he destroys both the blameless and the wicked, and he mocks at the calamity of the innocent. This is Job giving us the real hard and honest lament here. When he's looking out at everything that's going on in his own life, he sees nothing, hears nothing but God mocking.
Yeah. I kind of imagine Job like, saying all this stuff, and then it's like he's working up to this part right here, and he's saying all this stuff. And
that
he's
last
like,
line of verse 24?
Well, 23 and, well, actually 22, that second part of 22 through 24, he's working up to this therefore. And when he says, therefore, I say this, and you could sort of, he says, he destroys both the blameless and the wicked, is the opposite of what his friend just said. Mm. And so you could sort of see, you know, imagine the look on their faces. Like you didn't just
say that.
Yeah. Like, no, dude, let me tell you what conclusion I've come to. I come to the conclusion that you're wrong. He destroyed. It doesn't matter if you're blameless or you're wicked. When disaster brings sudden death, he mocks at the calamity of the innocent. Like, this is a string of things that I'm sure these guys are starting to like step back instead of, in the case like lightning strikes or something.
Yeah, and from Job's perspective, I mean, when he simply observes what's going on in his life, how could this not be the conclusion that he comes to?
Yeah,
right. I mean, if he is judging what is true, based upon what his eyes see, there really is no other conclusion that he can draw other than that, therefore, God destroys both the blameless and the wicked. Because all he's experiencing is destruction, even though he himself is blameless.
Yeah, well, his friend's argument is bad things don't happen to good people. And Job's argument is, yeah, they do. Like, that's what it is. Like, you're wrong. Yeah, yes. Bad things do happen to good people.
Yeah. Bad things happen to blameless people.
Yes.
The best of people, right? Look at my life. And then, I mean, the very last line is basically, listen, if God's not the one behind all this, well, then who would it be? I mean, all of this stuff is happening. And the one who, you know, removes mountains and places mountains in their place, and one who made the sun and the stars and all the constellations. Well, if he's not the one who's orchestrating all these events that are happening on Earth, well, then tell me who would it be? So it's a very strong monotheistic argument. If there's one God, then there's only one He behind all of these things, and He's obviously destroyed the righteous with the wicked, the blameless with the wicked. Job says He mocks at the calamity of the innocent. All of these things are happening, and God is the one who's behind them all. This is kind of Job's perspective at this moment. I mean, we're not done with his argument. He's actually got quite a ways to go, but we're about halfway through chapter 9, and we're at the end of our 40 minutes. So I guess we'll have to pick up his argument next time.
That's right. Well, I would like to say that Job is not wrong that bad things happen to good people. This is obviously most exemplified in Christ, where the worst thing happens to the only truly blameless man. And of course, I think it's R.C. Sproul that used to say, bad things happen to good people. That only happened once, and he volunteered for it. So.
And he volunteered, yes. All right. Great quote.
Yes, sir. All right, man. Well, I will see you next week.
All right. See you then.